give you anything?
Pano?
No, the devotee who was recording.
I haven't seen him today.
Yeah, and yesterday he
no. Oh. He was supposed to be here. He may come because of the festival.
It took longer?
There was this celebration of disappearance there for Shidaswami. So many devotees went there. So after his day, he may come a little late.
It's still going on? Or?
No, I think it's over. Slowly people are coming.
Okay. Well, I hope he comes because he had those recordings for the last couple of days. But today was his last day. Anyway, I know where he stays. Because I told him to do that.
Everything is
on the second floor means floor above or the
above us here. What about that? Don't know his name. He's working on computer.
Magisha.
Oh. This other one. This.
Oh, this. India.
Yes.
Okay.
He said I recorded yesterday all these two classes.
Oh, the one who's scanning on the scanning computer.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, that's good.
Everything's here.
You don't have to worry about that. All right. Great. All right, so we are just going to continue where we left off yesterday. We presented now that board is back there. Well, yeah, you could just as a reminder. Yeah, put that backside. This is the last one. Yesterday we presented this these five diagrams, and this is the fifth one, the complete one, that shows the cycle of desire and its reactions upon the psychology of the conditioned human being. Desire originally arising from avidya, primordial ignorance of the false ego, coming into the mind as bija, sinful desire, and flowering into papam, sinful action, which breeds two types of reactions, or the aparabdha reactions, unmanifest reactions. One of which becomes parabdha, manifest suffering in the form of body after body after the body. And the other type becoming the subtle kutta or sinful disposition of the mind. That our mind becomes habituated to performing sinful activities. And because of that state of mind, we continue to perform sins, life after life after life. And so this is called samsara, the cycle of birth and death. This is the state of the nityabada, the eternally conditioned soul. So, we all know the solution to this. Kali Santarana Upanishad 7 declares, Iti shodisha kalasya jivasya varana vinashanam tuta prakashate parabrahma megapai ravi rashmi mandali viti. In this way, the Maha Mantra of 16 names is the destroyer of the covering of the jivatma, which is composed of 16 parts. It is then only that the parambrahma Lord Sri Krishna shines before the jiva like the rays of the sun after the cloudy covering of the sky is removed. So in the first part of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, the holy names Hare and Krishna are uttered 8 times. In the second part, the holy names Hare and Rama are uttered 8 times. Thus, there are 16 names in the Maha Mantra. The 16 layers that cover the soul have already been explained. They are, first and foremost, the vasana-infected mind, which is the chief. We, yesterday, read a quotation in which these 16 coverings were mentioned, and the mind was said to be foremost, and it's the mind that gets infected by these vasanas or these bijas. And of course the other 15 are 5 gyanendriyas plus 5 karmendriyas plus 5 tanmantras or sense perceptions. Chanting the 16 holy names, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, rids consciousness of all these coverings. When consciousness is pure, it is illuminated by the rays of Lord Krishna's personal form. But even after chanting for a long time, we may find ourselves still troubled by vasana, or by these bijas, the appearance of sinful desires in the heart. So why is that? The reason is simple. It's aparad, offenses. The following verse from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Antya 8:26, shows that even after a devotee has accepted initiation from a bona fide spiritual master, indeed, even after he has entered the sannyas order, he again may fall victim to vasana if he commits Vaishnav aparad. So this is the verse. Ai ye Sri Madhavendra Sri Padaka Upeksha Karila Sei Aparadhe Inhara Vasana Janmila. You hear in this verse the word vasana. So this is a verse about Ramachandra Puri, who was one of Sri Ishwara Puri's disciples. Of course, Ishwara Puri's most famous disciple is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it is said here that Ramachandra Puri was thus denounced by Madhavendra Puri. Due to his offense, gradually material desire, vasana, appeared within him. This is because Ramachandra Puri was unfortunately a puffed up kind of disciple. When he heard his spiritual master in his last days lamenting that he had not achieved Mathura and had not achieved the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, he was actually lamenting in the mood of Srimati Radharani. So this was transcendental mood of separation. Unfortunately, Ramachandra Puri took this lamentation to be material, and he thought that it was necessary for him to instruct his spiritual master that, don't lament because you're having to give up your body. Just remember Brahman. Just remember that you're not the body. And in this way, be pacified in your last moments. So, of course, this was totally inappropriate. Ramachandra Puri was not only displaying his ignorance of the Vaishnava Siddhanta by giving instructions that are more or less advocating impersonalism, he was committing a great offense at the lotus feet of his spiritual master by daring in the very first place to give him instructions like this. So, therefore, Madhavendra Puri, he denounced Ramachandra Puri. This was on his the bed of his samadhi, where he entered into the Nitya Lila of Lord Krishna in his last moments, he actually denounced this disciple, Ramachandra Puri, telling him that, "I do not want to see your face at this time, because if I see your face when I leave my body, I will surely go to hell, because you are such an offender." So Ramachandra Puri had to leave. So Ramachandra Puri was already initiated. Not only that, he was already initiated in the sannyas order. Yet, as a result of Guru and Vaishnava Parad, we find that Ramachandra Puri became a victim of vasanas, of material desires. Therefore, in his activities, as described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he showed enviousness of other devotees, because he used to like to create situations in which he could then find fault in the behavior of other devotees. He would invite devotees to very nice, sumptuous feasts that he would arrange. And he would encourage them to take more and more prasad, nice prasad. And then after they had taken prasad, then he would say, "Oh, these so-called Vaishnavas, what sense enjoyers they are, filling their bellies with such sumptuous foodstuffs. This is not at all recommended for those who are on the path of Vairagya." So in this way, he was always trying to find fault with devotees. He was always trying to prove that, because he himself had a proclivity for being although he was initiated by a Vaishnava, he had a proclivity for being a Mayavadi, an impersonalist. And for at least displaying himself as being a great renunciate. He had this attitude that devotees who are not so much concerned with dry renunciation and indeed who honor the Lord and the devotees of the Lord in the holy days of the appearances of and disappearances of the Lord and his devotees by taking feast prasadam, nice feast prasadam, as the devotees are doing today. So he considered this all to be simply sense gratification. And so that is a symptom of his enviousness of devotees. And he even dared to criticize Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in a most ridiculous manner. He went to visit Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and he noticed, I discovered that this is actually a typical Bengali conclusion. So he saw some ants crawling on the ground in Lord Chaitanya's quarters, and this led him to conclude that, this sannyasi, meaning Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, he takes sweets at night. In the daytime, he's acting like a very pakka sannyasi, but at night, he must be taking nice sweets, otherwise why would ants be here? You see? Now, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami points out in his narrative that ants can be seen crawling anywhere and everywhere. But Bengalis do draw this conclusion. Why do I say this? Because I had a funny experience. I took my computer once to a repair person in Calcutta. He was just, I purchased an external monitor. Actually what he was doing, he was replacing the CD-ROM drive, which had gone defective, and he'd gotten a new CD-ROM drive, and he was putting it in. So he was removing the old one, and as he removed it, one ant crawled out from the inside of my computer. And then he looked at me and said, "Do you like sweets?" As if while working at my computer, I'm eating sweets, and the sweets are dropping, you know, and then I guess working their way inside the computer, and therefore there was an ant inside the computer. So I laughed when he said this, because I was remembering Ramachandra Puri. So anyway, in this way, Ramachandra Puri even offended Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So as clearly stated by this verse, the result of such aparad is, se aparadi inhara vasana janmila. Janmila means to give birth to. So that these offenses gave birth to vasanas, to the reappearance of kama bija in the heart of even, not only was he initiated, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had been initiated into mantra by Ishvara Puri, but he was even a sannyasi. He'd even taken sannyas. And still became victimized again by these kama bijas. So this is a lesson for us all, that if in our devotional service, particularly in the chanting of the holy name of the Lord, which as we have read, is the very means to remove the coverings, this gross and subtle coverings of the jiva, in particularly the mind, which is the abode of these bijas. If we commit nama parad, then we can expect, even though we're chanting, even though we're initiated, whatever we may be by upadhi designation, we may still be victimized. So Srila Prabhupada taught that the mind is subject to invasion by subtle entities. Now this topic, under which goes under such names as possession and psychic attack, is commonly dismissed by mental health professionals as some sort of superstition. But that is not so. Let us look at Srila Prabhupada's explanation in this quotation from a Bhagavad Gita class in Ahmedabad, which was given on 7 December 1972. Srila Prabhupada says that Krishna is described here as Madhusudana, the killer of the demon Madhu. Madhukaitava Adi. So Arjuna was attacked by a demon of forgetting his duty, being too much afflicted by bodily relationships. This is our position. In this material world, we are so much attached to this bodily relationship that it is to be considered just like we are ghostly haunted. In a poetry, Prema Vivarta, it is said that Pisachipaila yena mati chana hoy maya grasta jiva hoy se dasa upajoy. Note, that's the end of the quotation, so note that Srila Prabhupada said that Arjuna was attacked by the demon of doubt because his mind was afflicted by bodily relationship. In other words, his mental state offered the opportunity for an attack. The Pisachapaili verse Srila Prabhupada quoted compares people in Maya to people haunted by ghosts. What are these entities that enter the afflicted mind to grow strong there? Ghosts and demons, of which there are many kinds. Lust can be mentioned in this context, because in this context we have been talking about seeds of desire or lust that enter the mind, as we see, from the realm of avidya, ignorance, and ghosts are certainly denizens of the realm of avidya. And in the mind, they get strength, they grow up, they grow into, they become so powerful that they take command of our actions. And we have to act out these desires. And then that, of course, leads to us taking birth again and again, and it leads actually to a very change in our own consciousness, where we become kutam, we take on a sinful disposition. And this is exactly what happens to ghostly haunted people. The ghosts enter their minds and take control of their minds, And thus the people engage under the influence of the ghost in crazy behavior. And they take on a mental disposition by which we know them to be ghostly haunted. You see. These people are, their minds become just suitable hosts for ghosts. That was unintentional poetry there. So similarly, lust operates in the same way. Bhagavad Gita 3:40 states that lust invades the mind, intelligence and senses, just like ghosts do. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada writes, "The enemy has captured different strategic positions in the body of the conditioned soul. And therefore Lord Krishna is giving hints of those places, so that one who wants to conquer the enemy may know where he can be found. Mind is the center of all the activities of the senses, and thus when we hear about sense objects, the mind generally becomes a reservoir of all ideas of sense gratification. And as a result, the mind and the senses become the repositories of lust." So it's the same principle at work. The starting point of this process is the guna prabaha mind. Remember from yesterday, guna prabaha means afflicted by the material modes. The mind, the material mind is that mind which is agitated by rajoguna, tamoguna, and sattvaguna. We include sattvaguna, material mode of goodness, because if the material mode of goodness is not purified, then it will degenerate into rajoguna and tamoguna. But the actual real enemies of the mind are rajoguna, tamoguna. That's stated early on in the Srimad Bhagavatam that tadarajas tamo bhava kama lobdayasche chitte tananavritam stitvasattva prasidati. This is describing the purification of consciousness. So it says that when tamoguna and rajoguna and tamoguna and also kam, lust, are cleansed from the mind, then the mind comes to stitta sattva, steady goodness. So that's vishuddha sattva or vasudeva sattva, pure goodness. And how is that goodness experienced? Well, I'll give you a tip. That's goodness that we don't become bored of. You see, because this is actually what happens in the mind of a person in the material mode of goodness that causes him to become overwhelmed by rajoguna and tamoguna. That he's in the material mode of goodness, that means in terms of Krishna consciousness, he's following the program nicely, he's chanting his rounds nicely, he's going to class nicely, but there is some dissatisfaction that manifests primarily in the form of boredom. He thinks, this isn't enough. I'm doing all these things, but I don't know. This is not giving me what I want. And so his mind becomes agitated, rajoguna, and starts to branch out. Huh? What is Krishna warned about in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Bahu sakahinantascha, the mind that branch goes off into many branches is no longer ekaha, one pointed on Krishna, but finds many, many different engagements to occupy it. So this is what happens. We become bored with the simple standard of spiritual life and think, well, there's so many other things that I have to do. So many other duties that I have to take up. So many other pursuits that I have to go after. So this means the mind is now entering into the rajoguna. And the result of the rajoguna will be frustration. You see, one endeavors in rajoguna, working hard to earn money and then by this money to establish oneself nicely in regulated sense gratification. This will be the first excuse, you see. Yes, I want to be regulated also in my grihastha affairs, therefore I need money. But if one is afflicted by the rajaguna, I'm not, please don't mistake me, I'm not casting aspersions against grihastha dharma. I'm talking about the state of mind that one may develop in grihastha dharma, brahmachari dharma, any dharma, doesn't matter. But this state of dissatisfaction, that even after one has earned money and, you know, acquired this and that, he's still not satisfied, he's still frustrated. You see? And actually, because of these activities, his life has become much more complicated. Which is what, you know, if you go from brahmachari life to grihastha life, you have to be prepared for that. I mean, this will happen. If one goes from brahmachari ashram to grihastha ashram, your life will become more complicated. There's no doubt about that. But the question is just what you, internally, how you deal with that. You can deal with the additional complications in Krishna consciousness, and your mind does not have to be degraded. Or your mind may become more agitated and disappointed and disheartened because of these additional, oh, now I have so many bills to pay, my creditors are coming because the bills are due, and my debtors, those to whom I loaned money, those bums, they're not paying me back, and my God, it's so complicated, and my wife is nagging me, and my kids, and this and that, and so then if one is again not serious about Krishna consciousness, then the only other avenue to take is to enter into the tamoguna, the mode of ignorance, whereby one just says, ah, to hell with it, who cares? This is the attitude in the mode of ignorance, who cares? You see, so the creditors come and they start hauling off the furniture, and car gets repossessed, one is thrown out of one's apartment, the wife leaves with the children, you're not taking care of us! And I don't care anymore. He is living under a bridge with sleeping on a bottle. Here in Paris, if one looks under the bridges over the Seine, one will see these kind of people. So this is the tamoguna. One just has no motivation to do anything anymore. Except to gratify the senses in the most immediate and nasty ways possible, you see. Therefore, this type of alcoholic, this type of person who leaves everything to become an alcoholic, they will even drink aftershave lotion or wood alcohol. You know, this dangerous type of alcohol that can make you go blind. So they're addicted to intoxication, so they don't care. Let me go blind. I just satisfy this desire any way I can. This is the mode of ignorance. They don't care anymore about consequences. At least in the mode of passion, there's concern about the consequences of my activity. Therefore, one is working hard, trying to make money. You see, because one wants to enjoy, life, and at the same time, avoid the consequences of suffering. Now you can't do that. That's just the law of nature. That's suffering enjoyment. That's practically lesson A of Bhagavad Gita that Krishna begins to teach Arjuna in the second chapter, that sukha and dukkha are inseparable. It's like a coin. There's two sides to coin. In the States anyway, we say heads and tails, means, you know, when you flip a coin, it's a way of making a choice. It's kind of gambling, so I guess devotees shouldn't. Rather, we should go before the deity and try to get some indication from Super Soul what we should do. But those again who are under the modes of nature, when they reach a kind of fork in their life, I could go this way, I can go. Sometimes they flip a coin, you see. They flip a coin, catch it, go like that. Heads or tails, you know. Heads is yes, tails is no. And then they look, oh, no, okay. So sukha and dukkha are like two sides of the same coin, you see. Once you've accepted that coin, the coin meaning material attachment, once you've become attached to this material body and attached to the sensations of this body, the heat, cold, happiness, distress, honor, these are all called sensations or tanmatras, then you have to accept sukha and dukkha. There will be some sensations you will like and some that you won't like. And the mind, we've already explained, the psychology of the mind. The mind basically has two functions, sankalpa, vikalpa, acceptance and rejection. So if the mind is not guided by higher intelligence, if the mind is under the modes, then the mind will naturally accept sukha. You see? That which feels good, that which tingles the senses nicely, the mind will want more of that. And that which caused disturbance to the senses, the mind will want to reject. So this is the road to hell. Okay? As soon as we are accepting the mind as our guru in this regard, then we have a guru, a naraka guru, a guru who's not going to take us back home, back to Godhead, but a guru who's going to take us to hell, back to doghead, instead of back to Godhead. We're going to end up with the head of a dog in our next life. Because this is what the mind will do. The mind will just keep, keep giving me that gratification, gratification, gratification. And the circumstances are getting worse and worse and worse. But the mind just keeps demanding, gratify those senses, gratify, doesn't matter. Well, but now you're living under a bridge. Now you're... You know, you're dressed in rags. Now you haven't bathed for 5 months. Doesn't matter. Gratify those senses. Gratify those senses. Doesn't matter. I don't care. See, in this way, the mind, uncontrolled mind, just leads one deeper and deeper. First through Rajaguna and then into the limitless depths of Tamaguna. There's just no limit. So, yes, therefore the starting point of this whole miserable process is the mind agitated by the modes of nature. And this is, as I explained, can begin in the mode of goodness. You know, can begin, here I am dressed in devotee clothes and I've got tilak and kantimala and everything. And I'm chanting my rounds, I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to do. But somehow this isn't enough for me, somehow I'm just not very satisfied with this, and I heard some devotees talking about starting a business, and this sounds real interesting, and yeah, I think I've got business talent, and I want to make some money. Now again, this can be done for Krishna. Don't get me wrong. This can be done for Krishna, but the point is, if we enter into this mainly under the impulse of mental agitation, watch out. There's another way to enter into this. One consults one's spiritual master, one consults one's spiritual authorities. I mean, the agitation of the mind may be there, but one has to give it a back seat. You know, one has to put it in the, you know, hey, get in the back. You know, you're not going to be the reason why I'm going to get into something or not get into something. So then one goes to spiritual authorities and hears from them, and if they approve, yes, alright, this could be a good service for you to engage in this business with these other devotees and make Lakshmi for Krishna. And hopefully, I mean, we should, if we are in this situation, we should seek guidance. We should want to have every step of the way very carefully planned out. with reference to spiritual authority, so that we don't make missteps. You see. So then in this way, yes, we can be in Grihastha Ashram, we can do business and all of that, but still be in the secure position of Krishna consciousness because our activities are authorized. But if we simply follow the impulses of the mind, watch out. Because the lusty mind is never to be satisfied, no matter what you do. And this is the fix we see in people get themselves. There's so many examples in the material world, even of the successful people. Where do they end up? The successful multimillionaire businessmen, you know, because in truth, most, you know, I think this is, we can understand that most people who attempt to start businesses, the businesses fail. You see, in fact, there's a joke. How do you start? What is this joke I heard? Quite a funny joke. How do you engage in a small business in ISKCON? You start a big business in ISKCON. We have so many examples in ISKCON, you know. Devotees getting out of big plans, big business, big investment, and then in the end it's, you know, like the story of the Himalayas giving birth to some rats, you know. So that's the general experience. And in the material world, it can be seen, you know, so many little businesses fail, even big businesses fail. So that's the first thing. One may have the intention to make a lot of money, but the chances go against that. But even if one is successful, even if one joins the millionaires club, he's so fortunate. Does that mean one is happy? No. These people, they're burdened. They're burdened by so many anxieties. And therefore, as Srila Prabhupada once said, he was telling the story of one very wealthy businessman, well known in Bengal history. It might be his name might be C.R. Das, I'm not sure. But he was, in Prabhupada's youth, he was a big name. And so the story of his life was well known. And Srila Prabhupada told that this man, if it was C.R. Das or not, I'm not sure, but anyway, that he, after he had made, you know, his fortune, he was sitting out on the veranda of his house. And he was very glum. I mean, he had a great palatial mansion and there was a big veranda. And he was sitting there, a nice cushioned seat. And he was very glum and he was staring out at the street. And staring very intently at something out on the street. And so someone, his wife or someone, asked, what are you thinking of? And then he pointed out on the street. There was one sadhu who was just dressed in simple cloth. And sadhus in India, of course, generally they live by begging. They have no possessions, they live by begging. And so this rich man, he said, actually, I would like to be like him. I wish I was him. Because he was so much overburdened by anxieties. So he was, at least at that moment, thinking of seeing the sadhu and thinking how much easier it would be for me if I would just give everything up and just live like him. I don't know if that's what he ever did, but at least at that point he was thinking like that. So that's what happens to people. Materialistic people, people of materialistic minds, even when they become successful, their minds continue to harass them. So anyway, we are talking about, we've gone way off of the original point. The original point was how the mind under the modes of nature becomes host just like it does to these kama bijas, becomes host to inauspicious influences. So Srila Prabhupada directly compares the doubt that invaded Arjuna's mind to a demon. He directly compares lust to the enemy which invades the mind, occupies the mind and the senses. And so this is actually what is happening. So suppose the mind, suppose we find ourselves becoming depressed. So depression is recognized in the world today as a very major mental, not only, it's a very major health problem. It's expected to become the foremost health problem in the world, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. So what actually is happening in this light, in the light of what we've been going over? That being tamasic, depression plays host to tamasic entities that invade the mind. And these entities, they work within, they steal the mind's energy to intensify the sense of apathy, unhappiness, loneliness that are typical of the condition of depression. So as these entities grow stronger by sapping the mind's mental energy, they take command of the mind's activities. And this is how one becomes ghostly haunted. And this is what goes under the name of insanity in the modern world. Of course, most mental health professionals, they feel very uncomfortable with this sort of explanation that a person's mind has been taken over by ghosts and demons. They think this is something from the Middle Ages, and now we are advanced and we are scientific. But what is their way, modern psychiatry? You know, modern psychiatry's solution for all these problems is just to give pills that just deaden the influence of these entities in the mind. If someone's psychotic, if someone is hallucinating, or if someone is too depressed, they just give some pill that chemically balances the brain. Now this pill is not a cure. This pill is only masking the symptom. If the person goes off the pill, then again, he will slip back into that state. So this is not a cure. This is just a modern way, so pseudo-scientific way of masking the symptoms. So having invaded, such subtle entities become quote-unquote lords of our various inauspicious mental states like depression, anger, etc. The mental energy these entities exert is actually our own mental energy. They, so to speak, take a body from our own mind force. And though they grow to take command of our thoughts and actions, their entry ticket, which is the inauspicious mental state, is our own responsibility. See, it all depends on our own quality of mind. If we allow our mind to enter into the tamoguna, then the mind will become invaded by tamasic entities. You see? Because in the tamoguna, what is going on? They're going on the... It means I am attracted to tamasic activities which will play host to tamasic, demoniac, ghostly entities. Like one prominent activity in the tamaguna is intoxication. You see, this is especially why young people of recent generations, it's hard to say where it starts, but we could say, I could say my generation in the 1960s when we came of age. In fact, there was a song by The Who, My Generation. Talking about my generation. Hope I die before I get old. So that generation, they sort of introduced a whole new lifestyle, which is still being mimicked by the youth of today in different ways, which means to live totally irresponsibly, to take any and all different types of intoxicants, also to indulge in different sorts of illicit sexual activity, and so on and so forth. And, so when one does these activities, then one is just opening the doors to demoniac possession. Now, I knew a person, as I said, told you, gave some insight into when I was of those years. I had many interesting experiences. So I knew a person. I had he wasn't a close friend, but he was someone I knew who kept, it was the head of a mannequin, you know, like in the storefront windows, they have these dummies or these mannequins, clothes mannequins, so they dress up to show off their fashions. So he had the head of such a mannequin that he kept on a table in his room. And he had, under the influence of various cocktails of drugs, he had melted different colored wax. You know, he had different colored wax candles. He had let the wax pour from the candles over the head, so the head looked quite bizarre, you know, streams of blue and yellow and green. And he got to a state where he used to, you know, sit and converse with that head. So, you know, we could sometimes go over to his house, and this actually once happened. I wasn't there, but some friends of mine, some people I knew, they went to the house, they went to this guy, he had his own apartment, and they were knocking, they knew he was in there, and they were knocking on the door, and he wasn't answering, and then they could hear him moaning, and so they broke the door down. And they found that he had slashed his wrists and was bleeding all over the apartment. And so they rushed him to the hospital. And after he sort of came to more to somewhat saner level of consciousness and could speak normally after a couple days, then they asked him, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "The head told me to do it." He was talking, you know, because it was well known. I mean, it was already well known to his circle of friends that he would sit for hours in front of this head and have conversations with it. So once the head told him to cut his own wrists, and he did it. So obviously this is bizarre, to say the least. This is an example of demoniac possession. And it all starts with us, first of all, choosing to enter into, like this person, at some point he chose to enter into the mode of ignorance, to start to develop the habits of the mode of ignorance. And later on he became totally victimized by asuric entities who dominate that mode. So chanting the holy names of the Lord without offense purifies the mind completely. When the mind is perfectly spiritualized, it is host for pure spiritual entities. So there's a song by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur that begins, Doyal Nitai Chaitanya Boli Natre Amar Man, which means chanting the holy names, Doyal, which means merciful, Nitai Chaitanya, O my mind, please dance. Nache Amar Man. This indicates that the purified mind dances with Lord's Nitai and Chaitanya as they appear within it in the forms of their holy names. You see? So, this is experienced by devotees on the level of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So it, now we want to go on to the subject of samskaras, impressions. And this is related to what we've been discussing. So it is very important in dealing with our individual psychology that we understand samskaras, which means mental impressions. Almost every time this word appears in Srila Prabhupada's books, lectures, letters, and conversations, quote, Vedic reformatory performance, unquote, is meant. For example, the Vedic marriage ceremony is called Vivaha Samskara. Vivaha means marriage, and samskara in this usage also has a psychological sense, but it is a reformatory sense. The ceremony of marriage impresses the minds of the couple getting married that the vow they are taking is one of the most important in their whole lives, that they must preserve this solemn vow in years to come, in both good times and bad, etc. This is how the marriage vow, even in the Vedic, the one we do in ISKCON, there's also, from what I've observed, like in the Christian marriage, there's this some reference to good times and bad, you should stay together. So the whole idea of this ceremony, it's a, you see, this is, the ceremony itself is called samskara, but samskara means impression, and this, so the psychological sense of this term is that, or take the initiation ceremony, when we receive Harinam Diksha. So there's a whole ceremony, and we take a vow, and this is to impress us with the importance of receiving the holy name from a pure devotee of the Lord. That this holy name is now the greatest treasure of my life, and I must protect it. I must not be casual, whimsical with it. You know, someone gives you a valuable gem, and you start to toss it in the air and play with it, and, you know, bounce it off the wall. What is that? You know, what is your understanding of the value of this thing if that's how you're handling this great gift of this gem? So similarly, if we are very whimsical in our chanting after having received initiation, this is not very good. So that's why initiation is to be taken very seriously. This is the psychological sense of samskara. So it is sometimes said that when the newly married couple circles the sacrificial fire seven times together, this creates an impression in their minds that will last for seven lifetimes. Sinful events and associations also deeply impress our minds for years and even lifetimes together. Such sinful samskaras are closely associated with vasanas, or sinful desires, and kutta, sinful inclinations. Srila Prabhupada indicated this sense of samskara in a conversation of 11 September 1972 in Arlington, Texas. This is a conversation he was having with some Indian gentleman who came to visit him. So Prabhupada said, well, samskara, you can change in a second. Samskara may be powerful, indistinct. This means on the tape, it's indistinct what Prabhupada said next. Krishna assures you, aham tvam sarva pape vyomokshe shami, he will give you protection. Samskara means you did some sinful activities and you are suffering. But he can change your samskara immediately by surrendering to Krishna. You can change your samskara immediately by surrendering to Krishna. Why are you so much concerned with samskara? He says, sarva dharma prichija mamikam sharanam aham tvam sarva papibhyo moksha. The samskara as effects of sinful activities, that is troublesome. So it gives you protection. Masucha, don't worry. Why don't you take this? You don't want to change your samskara. And so who can help you? That is a different thing. You don't want to change. Otherwise, Krishna is ready to give you all help. How their samskaras change? You know, the context here is that Srila Prabhupada is talking with some Indian gentlemen, and especially in the early days of his preaching in the West, when he would meet Indians. Because unlike himself, these Indians had come to the West to earn money for sense gratification. And they had very much compromised themselves with low-class Western habits. So Prabhupada would really get on their case and preach very strongly to them. And their reaction would sometimes be like this person. This person had raised the question of samskaras. Because Prabhupada was pointing out, here are my disciples, they're Western people. They're born into this culture, but just see, they're strictly following their... They have become Vaishnava, they have accepted initiation. They're wearing tilak. They're devotees of Krishna. So the whole implication, why aren't you? What are you doing? And you're from India. So then this person was trying to excuse himself by appealing to samskaras. That, oh, these people, meaning the devotees, they must have had some very special samskaras, meaning some very special, you know, impressions left over from previous lifetimes' pious activities, and these impressions have led them to your lotus feet, and therefore they're such nice devotees, but I guess I just don't have these samskaras. I have other kinds of samskaras. But this is Prabhupada's reply. Is that you don't want to change, that's all. That whatever your samskaras, you may have sinful impressions, this which it would manifest as this kutta, sinful disposition. And yes, so therefore you're presently caught up in materialistic affairs. But if you surrender to Krishna, this is Krishna's promise, don't worry. I will remove you from all danger. I will protect you from sinful reactions. This is exactly what Krishna says. I will protect you. I will give you full protection. And then Prabhupada, he says, how their samskara is changed. From the very beginning of their life, they are addicted to these principles, illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, gambling. How they have changed. They don't touch it. How has it become possible? The guest Srila Prabhupada addressed here replied that he believed Prabhupada's disciples had been great yogis in their past lives. By saying this, he was suggesting that they had powerful samskaras embedded in their minds that brought them to Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet. Conversely, one who had no such, you know, powerful yoga samskaras would not be able to take shelter of the pure devotee. But Prabhupada asked this guest why he was also not such a yogi. He replied that he didn't know. Prabhupada said, because you don't surrender. That is the fact. If you surrender, you become also a great yogi. So Prabhupada was stressing, you see, and this is very important for us to understand, Prabhupada's insight into the human condition. Prabhupada, this is a well-known quotation from Prabhupada, that man is the architect of his destiny. So sometimes, even as devotees, we try to understand our destiny in terms of astrology, or, you know, even some devotees have gone into things like past life regression, which, if you can tolerate my... my editorial comment is just bogus. You know, just... it's so bogus because this past life regression, it involves... first you enter into a hypnotic state. You see, you lay down, you get relaxed. The therapist, he puts you into a trance, which means... your mind enters hypnotic state, and as Nitai Gauranga Prabhu, he himself confirmed, being trained in psychology himself, that a hypnotic state or such a trance state is just a state of the mind dreaming while it's awake. So what does the mind do when it dreams? It just freely produces images by association. So then your therapist, your so-called past life regression therapist, what is he doing? He's making suggestions, you see. He's saying, now you find yourself back in the womb of your previous mother, just on the verge of taking birth. You see, he's making a suggestion. So the mind in that state of free association dreaming. You see, producing visions by free association is very, very open to suggestion. So he's making the suggestion. The mind latches onto the suggestion and starts to concoct that image. You start to dream that while you're awake. Yes, 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 I'm within the womb of my mother. I can see it. I can see it. And then, you know, and then the mind is just... This is actually one very serious scientist who is an advocate. He believes he has proof that we do reincarnate, but this is not his proof. His proof has nothing to do with this past life regression. His proof is, his name is Ian Stevenson. He's very well known. And he says you can't tell the you can't establish anything on the basis of this past life regression because you don't know if your mind is actually experiencing something from a previous lifetime or if your mind is experiencing some hidden memory from this lifetime. For example, there was a case of a woman actually, who went through this regression therapy. And then she had the memory of being a girl in France of 200, 300 years ago. And there was a whole story. She lived in such and such village. She gave the name of the village. And then she started reciting some verses in French language of that time. And she did not know French. So then this was, wow, this is proof. This is proof of past life regression. How is it possible? Here she is. She's, you know, remembering her life, and she's describing the village just as it was in 18th century France, giving the name of the village, even reciting the French as it was spoken in that time. But then it turned out, you know, sometime later, the lady was cleaning out her attic, and she found a book that she had read as a little girl when she was 7 years old, which told the story of a girl living in 18th century France, describing that village, giving that name, and even giving that poem. And that's what she remembered under past life regression. Although she didn't remember actually reading it as a little girl. She just remembered it as a direct memory. You see? That's the kind of tricks the mind plays. So this was, you know, a big, much-hailed case for some time. This proves past life regression. You see, but then she announced to the world, well, actually, it all came out of this book I read when I was a little girl. And that kind of, you know, pricked the big balloon. So one doesn't know if one is doing this past life regression memory therapy, whether one is actually having a memory of the past life or some hidden memory of this life, or if the mind is just dreaming something, just concocting something right on the spot, just making something up. Like we dream. We dream at night. We just have dreams. You know, so it can be like that. This is Professor Stevenson's argument against past life therapy. You cannot distinguish between the three. So this is not valid. Yes?
What about these cases of split personalities?
Well, there's a lot of controversy about that, whether that is actually real psychological phenomena. There have been advocates of this, it's called the MPD, multiple personality disorder. There have been advocates of this, but then, you know, their work has been severely criticized by other psychiatrists as not being very scientific. But anyway, if something like that does happen, then the Vedic explanation would be that the person is ghostly haunted. The person's mind has become host to at least one, if not more, subtle entities that take over. I mean, it's certainly from the Vedic point of view, it is possible. But MSD as a pop, you know, it, it a few years ago, it became a very big thing, and there were so many people who were being diagnosed as having MSD, multiple personality disorder. But the pendulum has swung to the other side. Now it's considered to be quite rare. Now, because I think also it was probably a case of, you know, again, the therapist by suggestion. This is very important. You see, because people go to therapists like they go to gurus, you know. Like they go to a guru. I mean, a therapist is a guru for a person with some mental disorder. And he's just like this, and then the therapist just suggests something, and the person is going with it. The person's mind is going with it, you see. So the therapist may suggest, maybe there's someone else inside of you. And then the mind latches onto that and starts to create, yes, actually there's a little boy inside of me named Joe. And this boy is very sad because he's an orphan. And blah, blah, you know, the mind just starts... So apparently from what I've read, MSD is really not, you know, authentically that widespread. But when it came into vogue, that's what happens in the field of psychology and psychiatry, that different mental diseases come into vogue, you know. Suddenly everyone has multiple personality disorder, or suddenly everyone is having repressed memories. That was also a few years ago. Suddenly everyone, practically every woman had been abused by her father when she was a little girl, you know. It just came into vogue, and women would go to therapists, and the therapist would say, so how you feel? Well, I'm not sure how I feel. Sometimes I feel sad. Do you think your sadness had anything to do with your father? Well, I don't know. Maybe. Do you think when you were a little girl that your father might have done something to you? Well, I don't think so. No, think about it. Think about it carefully. Then they start, and then the mind starts generating. But then time and time again, it was, you know, because these would become court cases. The lady would suddenly believe these memories and become very indignant that when I was only 3 years old, my father did such and such to me. All these years I trusted him, and then she would file a court case, and then there would be an investigation, careful investigation of the circumstances, and it would be discovered that when she was 3 years old, her father was in the military, and during this very time she was supposed to be molested. He was posted in Korea, and she was in Connecticut with her mother. Father was, you know, thousands of miles away on the front, you know, fighting, and so it was not possible that he abused her, and this is all simply a concoction of the mind. So there was a time when this was in vogue, but then after many, many of these court cases being carefully investigated and proving that it couldn't have happened, so then it, you know, then therapists are not so eager anymore to suggest that you might have been abused by a parent, you know. So you see, this is how the mind works. We don't want to get off the main point here. The main point is that that even after one takes the devotional service, a devotee may be haunted by long-lasting impressions of sinful life events and sinful associations. And that we all know. Many years ago, a godbrother confided to me his own difficulty with such samskaras. Some names of great personalities in the Srimad Bhagavatam reminded him of dirty words that he used to hear and chant in his karmi life. So when he'd be sitting in the class and some name would be mentioned, then he would associate it with this dirty word, and he would feel himself, you know, very ashamed and condemned. Why am I thinking of this, you see, here in this holy assembly of the Bhagavatam? And so he was once telling me this, you know, I always have these troubles, you know. So this is a good example of what a samskara does to the mind. While in the subtle body, Srila Prabhupada writes in this purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 4:29-78, we create many plans to enjoy sense gratification. These plans are recorded in the spool of one's mind as bija, the root of sinful activities. So here's actually a very interesting explanation of the bijas. They're produced out of ignorance, but these bijas actually they can be the seed form of our past sinful activities that we performed in previous lifetimes. Or they're just the seeds of innate material desire that are innate in everyone. They can be either one, just nature itself, because nature itself is initiating these sinful activities when we come under her control. But then we perform so many sinful activities, and they are also recorded deep in the mind, and they may also reappear. So even everyday events are permanently recorded. When you were a small child, there was a day when you ate an orange for the first time. That experience impressed your mind, and that impression is always there beneath your conscious awareness. That experience of the distinctive color, shape, smell, texture, and taste of an orange can at any time be replayed in your consciousness. A friend tells you he is going to the fruit shop and will bring you back an orange. The full experience of orange enjoyment suddenly floods your mind. That is samskara. The mind is laden with samskaras from all our previous births, whether as demigods or demons or animals or birds or insects or plant or fish. But only certain samskaras that are appropriate to this life have conscious and subconscious influence upon us now. The more an original experience provokes emotions, that means the more an experience that we're having now in this lifetime provokes emotions that are hidden within us, the stronger the influence of the lingering samskara. You see, that's how we can tell. You can tell your past samskaras, because some people, you know, you see this in the emotional state of people. Some people, let's say, a song, an old song, just makes them cry. They hear some old song, and their eyes get wet, and they start to cry. Other people, who are of the same generation and know the same song, it's like, a stupid old song. They don't care at all, you see. So this is due to samskaras, different impressions in different people's hearts. We associate. Here's that song, and so this person is associating that song with some sentimental samskara, whereas the other person, for him, he never liked the song anyway, or, you know, whenever he heard that song, something really stupid was going on, and he just, you know, so he just has this, you know, this attitude, it's just a dumb song, I don't care, I don't like it, you see. So you can see the difference of these impressions make on different people. So samskaras are under the control of Paramatma, Matak Smritik Jnanam Apohanam Cha. The Lord says, from me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So remembrance also includes samskaras. What we remember, and that remembrance, you know, it can be a full-on memory, or it can be a kind of lingering, you know, nostalgic impression, a kind of even intuition of something, that deja vu, as they say, you know, just a sort of association we're not so sure of, but somehow it provokes an emotional response. But all of that is coming out of memory, and all of that is controlled by the super soul. So those samskaras that he's allowing to influence this life of ours now, that's our parabdha karma. That's the karma that we're suffering, enjoying at present. So also the things that go on in our minds at present, even as devotees, You see, that's Prarabdha Karma. And what should we do about that? What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Tatiksha. You have to just tolerate it. You see, if you start to act on it, you know, like there's this thing called midlife crisis, but Nittai Gauranga says there's even now there's quarter life crisis. That I guess it just means people are becoming more and more crazy. but even at age 25, which is the quarter life, you know, a young man or woman can have a crisis. But previously it would be around age 50, you see. It would mean that, and that's more, I mean, that seems to me at age 50 is more in tune with the Lord's plan, because at age 50, that there is supposed to be a big change of life. Like Srila Prabhupada would say, 50 is the age for that a man should start to make preparations to leave his material entanglement, because that by that age the children have grown up. He should wind up his family responsibilities. He should be now focusing on his spiritual life. So this is traditionally a time of vanaprastha and sannyas. But in any way, at age 50, it seems natural that we start to review what we've done up till that time. We look back. When you reach, I'm in my 50s, so believe me, I know this. You look back more than you look ahead, you see. You've got more in back of you than in front of you. So the mind's tendency is to more reflect on what's happened. When you're younger, then you're more looking ahead, you see. Not in this lifetime, at least, not much has happened yet. So you're more, you know, especially when you're a teenager. Teenagers, they are always like that, you know. I'm not doing anything. I mean, nothing's happening. I mean, you've got to do something, you know. That's the typical teenage mentality. We've got to go out and do something because nothing's happening, man. You know, it's a drag, you know. But, you know, when you reach your 50s, you've done a lot of things. And so the mind tends to look back. And when the mind looks back, then you get feelings for those things that you've done. And then this can lead to what's known as midlife crisis. So, a man or a woman will look back and think, what is my life meant up till now? Really nothing. I just got married to this person and we had some kids. But I don't really think this was the person I was really meant to share my life with. And so, that's why... not just men, but also women. At that time, you know, they start having adventures. You know, they start, you know. I mean, more and more even women, they start going out and you know, experimenting, playing the field. You know, cheating on their husbands, and their husbands are cheating on their wives, or they get divorced, or you know, after divorce, then you see the old guy. You know, 55, 60-year-old guy, gray hair, and he's got an 18-year-old girl on his arm. This in the karmi life is what midlife crisis often leads to, you know. They just try to live their life over again, because their mind is taking them back. So then it's like, well, let's do it all over again. But it's ridiculous, you know. Or the lady, the woman, she goes out and gets herself a facelift, you see. That means this plastic surgery where they pull back the skin to get rid of the wrinkles, and they tie the skin up back here under the hair, you know. And then she looks very youthful for 4 years, because it takes 4 years, and then again the skin starts to sag because she's an old lady, you know. And then sometimes they get again a facelift. And I once saw in, when I was on the BBT library party, we visited Hawaii. And Hawaii is a playground for young and old. So we were once, I was with His Holiness, now he's gone back to Godhead, but His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj at that time Ghanisham Das. So we were in a market together, just buying some boga. And we saw this woman. My God. I mean, she apparently had so many facelifts, and her skin was stretched so tight that it looked like a skull, just covered with skin, you know. I mean, she looked terrible, you know. But she had, you know, put all kinds of makeup and eyeliner. But she looked, you know, like you take a skull and you put makeup, you know, put lipstick on it, and she looked horrible. You know, like we both went, ah! We saw her. It was like around the corner. Ah, my God! You know? Talk about seeing a ghost, you know. But she was thinking in her mind, you know, my skin is smooth. Yeah, as smooth as the bones underneath. You know? Just underneath. So, but that's what happens. The mind goes back and wants to replay the life, so they do all these ridiculous things. But actually, the real purpose of the midlife crisis, when one is looking back on life and thinking, what was it all worth, is that one should then give up material life and dedicate oneself 100% to spiritual life. And that was, interestingly, that was Srila Prabhupada's, the purport of Srila Prabhupada's letter that he wrote to, because Prabhupada had been, before he met his spiritual master, a Gandhian. He'd been a follower. Prabhupada said, I was addicted to the movement of Mahatma Gandhi. He was 23 years old, but he was describing himself humbly in that way. That was a great movement in India at that time. Actually, I remember looking in old news magazines from, because I used to like to, in thinking of Srila Prabhupada's life, I used to like to investigate news reports from those days, what was happening in the world when Prabhupada was a young man. And I remember that the movement of Gandhi actually spread outside of India, and he had followers in particularly in Great Britain, because India was a colony of Great Britain, so Gandhi's movement influenced a number of, it was sort of like a youth movement at the time, a number of wealthy, intellectual, young British people who had, I guess, nothing better to do. That's why young people become hippies and punks, because they got nothing better to do with their lives. So that, in those days, they became followers of Gandhi, and I even saw a picture of a British girl, young girl in her 18, 19, and she was wearing a sari, and she had a big dot, and she was, you know, the picture said, it was from some London news magazine, one of our local Gandhians, you know. And she was walking down this Piccadilly Circus or something, I don't know, somewhere in London, wearing a sari. So any Prabhupada said, he was certainly addicted to Gandhi's movement. And then later, after, in the 40s, after, of course, having practiced Krishna consciousness, been a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati for many years, he wrote a letter to Gandhi advising him that now you should give up your political affairs. You've already sort of half adopted the life of a sadhu, but it's all for politics. So give up that politics and actually follow Bhagavad Gita. Stop using the Gita as a platform for political discourse, and really live out the purport of the Gita. But Gandhi apparently ignored that letter, and not long later he was shot. He was assassinated. And Prabhupada often referred to that it was apparently no accident that Prabhupada inspired, well, it's never an accident, that Prabhupada was inspired to write that letter, but he was inspired by Krishna to write that letter, and that letter had profound meaning for Gandhi, but Gandhi was either too busy or whatever, and then he was cruelly killed. So this is all the result of samskaras, impressions in the mind. So we will continue tomorrow, going from there. I think tomorrow we'll be getting into because samskaras, then we just actually just touched on the subject. We talked about how different people have different impressions in their minds and thus have different reactions to different circumstances. So tomorrow we'll be going into personality typology. The whys and wherefores, there are different types of material personalities, different natures of people. And we'll mention a few things. If Nitai Gurango is here, he would probably give an extensive explanation from Western psychology. I will only touch on that slightly. Mainly I'll be talking from the Vedic standpoint. So we'll get into that. We'll see how far we go. We are actually winding up the material. This class, I don't think, will last longer than next week. So we're now, what is today? Thursday?
Yes.
So I don't think it will last longer than Friday of next week. So anyway, those who can continue to come, please continue to come. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So you delivered?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. No, I will do it.
Bicycle.
Okay, yeah. Actually, I have to go get something first.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.